On this week in enterprise tech, malware's getting really sophisticated. So we talk about how Intel is trying to take the lead here and baking some new anti-malware defense mechanisms directly into their CPUs. We'll see how that goes. Plus, we talk about how organizations are really wondering what the new normal is around cybersecurity. Curtis will take us through that. Plus, we have a great guest. DevSecOps has come to being the saving grace to many organizations out there, especially with that remote workforce being increased. Now, Galen Emery is the lead compliance and security architect at Chef Software, and he's going to take us through what Chef is doing to help. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out lastpass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 398, recorded June 19th, 2020. Cooking up DevSecOps and compliance recipes with Chef. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LastPass. Prepare for the unexpected in your business with LastPass, trusted by over 17 million users and 61,000 businesses worldwide. Visit lastpass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. And by ExtraHop. ExtraHop helps you keep your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Get tips on securing and supporting remote access or check out the full product demo at extrahop.com/enterprise. And by LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. LinkedIn has the targeting tools that can help you focus on reaching your precise audience down to their job title, company name, location, and more. See how LinkedIn can help you with a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit to launch your first campaign. Visit LinkedIn.com/Twit. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm Louis Borowski, your host and your guide through this big giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own enterprise and security expert, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, how are you doing down there in the great state of Florida?
Well, here in the great state of Florida, we may get rain this afternoon because it is, after all, summer and Florida. So there you go. But while we're inside getting away from the rain, it's also true that we're thinking about security. And thank goodness we are, because there's a lot to think about and a lot to write about over at Dark Reading. But I'm taking a break from over there to be right here with the Twit Riot. Can't think of any place I'd rather be.
Well, thanks for being here. Well, speaking of experts, we also have our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, how's the packing coming?
It's getting there. It's amazing how much junk you accumulate in 15, 20 years. The house is getting there. The lab is getting there. I finally closed down all my 3D printing, and that stuff's all getting packed up. And unfortunately, cleaning out an SLA printer is challenging. Lots of resin all over the place, and the resin that gets mixed in with isopropyl alcohol is considered a kind of it's not really hazardous, but I have to go through a procedure to properly dispose of it. So I'm going to have to fork over a little money to a chemical disposal company. So for those of you thinking about going to an SLA printer, be very careful. The post-processing is actually quite a bit of work, and you end up with some chemicals that need to be properly disposed of. But other than that, I hope you like my background. This is a shot that Curtis's dear wife took when we were in Aruba.
Beautiful. Very nice. Well, thanks, guys, for being here. We've had a pretty big week in enterprise, especially around security. So I think we should definitely get started. Malware is getting really sophisticated, and a lot of hardware manufacturers want to make and bake that into some of their control there with their main hardware. So we'll chat about how Intel is trying to lead that force. We're trying to bake in anti-malware defenses directly into its CPUs. Also, organizations are wondering what the new normal will look like around cybersecurity, especially with COVID out there and remote workforces. Curtis will definitely take us through that. Plus, DevOps and DevSecOps has come to be a saving grace for organizations, especially with that increased remote workforce. And we have Gallen Emery. He's the lead compliance and security architect at Chef Software to take us through what Chef is doing to help. But before we get to all that enterprise goodness, we have to jump into this week's blips. Now, listen up, app developers out there. If you're on app platforms for Apple, Basecamp has a lesson for you when you're releasing new apps in the Apple ecosystem. Now, as the dust settles from the recent storm coming from this fight, we learned some more about Basecamp's new email app release. And it's just shy of Apple's annual developer conference as well, WWDC. Now, if you've ever heard of Basecamp, you know they have some pretty good software out there. And they released a new email system called Hey. That's right, Hey. Now, they claim Hey is what it offers a better experience for specific types of users than normal email systems. Now, Hey is like no other system out there, where it's focused at zero inbox users, as well as users who like to keep their email neat. Now, it includes a built-in screener that asks for users to confirm whether or not they want to receive email from specific addresses, and then inbound emails are triggered and triaged into different trays, such as the inbox or IMbox, standing for important, then containing only the comms for specific users who are important to them, as well as handling newsletters and other ways of sorting and sifting and making things kind of bubble to the top that are important. Now, however, this is not what Apple's main kerfuffle is about here. Now, Apple told Basecamp that Hey violated the rule 3.1.1 in the Apple Store's review guidelines. Now, what is this mysterious rule? Well, basically, it's the one that says if you want to unlock features or functionality within your app, you must use in-app purchase. Now, Apple wants a taste of it, of course. Now, Hey requires users to pay a $99 annual subscription fee to access its features and services, but offers a free trial period as well. But it does not allow users to subscribe within the app. Now, instead, users must go to Hey's website to sign up through Basecamp's own billing system, as well as the case for many other popular apps like Spotify and Netflix. Now, Basecamp CTO David Hansen, launched a firestorm of public criticism of Apple after Apple rejected an update to Basecamp's new email app. Now, normally this would look like a tantrum, right? But I don't think a CTO would take to the mattresses if he didn't smell something else funky out there, right? So the outrage also stems from a strongly held and often voiced belief that Apple's 15 to 30% cut of the subscription revenue gained through its payment system is not justified. So for his part, Hansen made it clear that Basecamp doesn't intend to just make this change at Apple's request. Now, the question really is the Apple tax justified? You be the judge.
Well, 60% of businesses plan to spend more on cyber insurance. Organizations of all sizes plan to invest more in cyber insurance in the coming years, but small and mid-sized enterprises, or SMEs, are allocating more of their budgets compared with large companies. A new survey of more than 1,000 businesses revealed that 65% of the SMEs plan to spend more on cyber insurance in the next 2 years, compared with 58% of large enterprises. More than 70% of SMEs currently have a coverage limit lower than $1 million and less than the total cost of expenses and loss related to a cyber attack they have experienced in the past or expect to face in the future. The research revealed approaches to cyber insurance vary across industries, with life sciences, healthcare, retail, hospitality, and telecom undercovered and with the biggest gap between their coverage limits and expected losses. Overall, though, on average, 45% of businesses of all sizes think it's likely they're going to experience a breach sometime in the next year.
Well, this story is about how Cox is slowing internet speeds for entire networks to punish a single heavy user. Cox Communications is lowering internet upload speeds in entire networks, neighborhoods, to stop what it considers excessive usage, in a decision that punishes both heavy internet users and their neighbors. Cox, a cable company with about 5.2 million broadband customers in the United States, has been sending notices to some heavy internet users, warning them to use less data and notifying them of neighborhood-wide speed decreases. In the case we will describe in this article, this is Ars Technica, a gigabit customer who was paying $50 extra per month for unlimited data was flagged by Cox because he was using 8 terabytes to 12 terabytes a month. Cox responded by lowering the upload speeds on the gigabit download plan from 35 meg to 10 meg for the customer's whole neighborhood. Cox confirmed to Ars Technica that it has imposed neighborhood-wide slowdowns in multiple neighborhoods in cases like this one, but didn't say how many excessive users are enough to trigger a speed decrease. You know, this is really sounding like the old adage of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So as a personal message to the big ISPs out there, keep in mind that wireless internet service providers and 5G is coming. And this consumer is taking a really hard look at dumping my current carrier.
Now, Hong Kong residents are always wondering how much the Chinese government will get involved with their digital footprint. Now, some believe that eventually the Chinese Communist Party of the Hong Kong government will dig through their history and arrest them for harming national security. Now, this is why many users of social networks like Facebook are downloading gigabytes of data from their accounts in order to delete the accounts forever. In fact, WhatsApp groups across the city are being scrubbed and social media posts are being erased. Now, the reason for all this sudden self-censorship? Well, the impending national security law that Beijing is about to impose on Hong Kong. Now, the details of the draft law have yet to be unveiled, but China experts and activists in Hong Kong fear that the part of the new restrictions will see China import its draconian surveillance and censorship network, as well as known as the Great Firewall, into the city. Now, it may not happen overnight, and Hong Kong's position as a global financial hub will mean a different approach is needed compared to mainland China. But for those most at risk of being silenced and arbitrarily thrown into prison, there's little doubt that the Great Wall, a Great Firewall, is coming to them. Now, it's back in 2019 when Beijing decided to draft a national security law and when things started to go downhill. Now, China's rubber stamp parliament passed the national security law last month, but details of what it contains won't be until it's published, which is expected to happen in the coming days. Now, the law will likely include the criminalization of the kinds of speech that are considered lawful and unproblematic in Hong Kong. Now, this restriction will very much extend to the internet as well. Now, this is just another signal that with the increased dependency on the internet for communications and social interactions, having it free to speak is even more critical.
Well, here with the coronavirus all over the place, most contact tracing apps fail basic security. Government agencies and private organizations that are developing contact tracing applications to help citizens keep informed about their potential risk of infection have failed to provide adequate protections against compromise and hacking, mobile security firm GuardSquare stated in a report published on Thursday. The company analyzed 17 different Android applications looking for 6 different types of security countermeasures that the company deems necessary to protect user privacy and prevent the data collected by the contact app from being used for unforeseen purposes. Only one of the 17 applications included full encryption and obfuscation of sensitive data, according to the report. Contact tracing is widely considered to be a necessary step for countries to take to continue to open up their economies while reducing the transmission of infectious diseases. Manual contact tracing, the only effective method in the past, requires a massive workforce. Before the epidemic, state, local health departments employed fewer than 2,000 contact tracers, but anywhere between 1 and 300,000 may be necessary. In its analysis, GuardSquare deemed 6 different forms of data protection to be necessary to protect a user's privacy on the applications. The code should have obfuscation to make reverse engineering more difficult, string encryption to protect sensitive code variables and names, asset encryption to prevent attackers from accessing parts of the program, and additional obfuscation to harden the software. In addition, the program should have checks to prevent running on a compromised device or in an emulator. These measures don't even take into account how the application and the government behind the application handles the data. And yet, only a single application out of 17 managed to have all of these application hardening measures in place.
Well, another one. The U.S. falls out of the top 10 average internet speeds globally in 2020. But that's just because the other countries are faster. The COVID-19 pandemic has many of us working and learning from home, which means access to fast internet is more important than ever. Unfortunately, despite being the richest country in the world, the U.S. has fallen out of the top 10 list for the countries with the fastest broadband speeds. Based on recent data from speedtest.net's Global Index, first highlighted by decisiondata.org, for the past few years, the U.S. has typically hovered between number 7 and number 10 among countries with the fastest broadband speeds. But in the last year, average broadband speeds in the U.S. haven't improved as quickly as other developed nations. In April of 2019, average broadband download speeds in the U.S. were about 118.6 megabits per second, placing America at number 7 on the list of countries with the fastest internet speeds. A year later, average download speeds had only risen to 132.6 megabits per second, placing the U.S. 11th behind Macau, Denmark, and Sweden. Considering just how much money the U.S. government has been forking over to the big ISPs, this is a pretty sad state of affairs. Maybe all that money should go to the small ISPs like wireless internet service providers.
Well, folks, it wouldn't be an enterprise week without a leak. Now, this week, Australia's government and institutions are being targeted by ongoing sophisticated state-based cyber hacks. Now, as the data unfolds, it seems that the attacks have been going on for some time now. Now, the government wishes to just raise public awareness. Now, if you may be wondering, what are the targets? Well, according to the Prime Minister, targets span across government, industry, political organizations, education, health, essential service providers, and operators of other critical infrastructures. Now, what is Australia is sure is that there is a state actor behind the hack because the scale of the nature of the targeting and the tradecraft. Now, cyber intelligence experts have long linked various attacks in Australia to China. That's right. They say China is one of the few states, along with Russia, Iran, and North Korea, which have the capacity for such attacks and are not allied with Australia. Now, however, they also note that the cyber espionage between countries and even allies is common. In fact, Australian intelligence agencies suspected China of carrying out the Parliament hack back in 2019. Now, what we do know here is that China has since imposed tariffs on Australian barley, stopped beef imports, and warned Chinese citizens and students about the quote-unquote risks of traveling to Australia for tourism or education because of racist incidents. Now, Australia has also ratcheted up its rhetoric here as well. So this means tensions and tempers are flaring between the two countries. Let's hope public awareness regarding all those current events will help ensure better safety for Australian citizens. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's LastPass. Now, it's always important to have a plan for the unexpected, right? Well, LastPass helps you plan. People have their favorite tool that saves time when they're trying to get things done, and mine is definitely LastPass. I love LastPass. In fact, I use LastPass so often, I don't even know I use it anymore. Now, think about it. You have a username and password for every site you go to, especially the ones you find most important to you, your financial sites, your business sites, the social networking sites, email, you name it. It's really hard to remember all of those, right? Well, that's where LastPass saves us all, that autofill feature. You don't have to worry about worrying about those unique passwords or remembering them anymore. It really just helps you. It just helps you fill them in anytime, anywhere on any one of your devices. Now, I actually have integrated with it Active Directory. So now I only have to remember one password, the network login password, and I still get access to all of my passwords. I don't have to even remember another master password there. In fact, I actually used LastPass recently, the authenticator, and it literally saved me time and money. Now, for businesses, LastPass is an amazing solution that not only ensures better security practices, but makes things more efficient. Now, LastPass can be deployed quickly in the midst of any event to ensure businesses can keep running smoothly and every employee login is secure. Now, single sign-on manages employee access in a centralized view, so ITs can always have insights into who has access to what and from where. And in fact, enterprise password management ensures oversight of shadow IT and enforceable policies across all password protected accounts. Now, MFA, multi-factor authentication, requires additional factors to prove a user's identity, while the use of biometric and contextual factors make the process smooth for employees and really easy. Now, businesses should be thinking about additional layers of defense beyond their passwords, and LastPass has got you covered here. Not only does it not send or store the master password, if LastPass can't access your data, hackers can as well. That's right. That's right. And in fact, encryption happens exclusively at the device level before syncing the LastPass for safe storage. So only users can decrypt their data. Now, they also use 256-bit AES encryption, and that's the same encryption type that's utilized by banks and military, so you can ensure that it's secure. Now, LastPass protects while providing a seamless workflow for your employees. Account access and passwords can be shared and securely between employees, whether they're in the office or working remotely, and employees get secure access to their work applications with single sign-on and password management, and there's an offline mode. That's why for both password management and multi-factor authentication, so employees can always access what they need, even when offline. Now, if it sounds like LastPass has considered it all, especially for security and productivity, then you're hearing right. LastPass can help make remote work simple and secure. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help your business stay productive and secure no matter what. That's LastPass.com/twit. And we thank LastPass for their support of this week, Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, we all know malware is getting sophisticated, right? A lot of hardware manufacturers, they want to make it harder for those hackers and those attackers to have malware take control. Now, in steps to gain control, Intel is trying to take the lead here and try to bake malware anti-malware defenses directly into their CPUs. Now, we all know the history of hacking has largely kind of been the back and forth game, with attackers devising a technique to breach a system, defenders constructing a countermeasure that prevents the technique, and hackers devising a new way to bypass the security system. Kind of the back and forth, right? Now, Intel is ready to go head to head there. They have announced that it's planned to bake a new measure directly into its CPUs that's designed to thwart software exploits that execute malicious code on vulnerable computers. Now, it's called Control Flow Enforcement Technology, or CET, and it represents a fundamental change in the way processors execute instructions from applications such as web browsers, email clients, or even PDF readers. That's right. Now, it's jointly developed by Intel and Microsoft. Now, CET is designed to thwart a technique known as return-oriented programming, or ROP, now, which actually hackers use to bypass anti-exploit measures software developers introduced about a decade ago. Now, ROP, as return-oriented programming is usually called, was software exploiters' response to protections such as executable space protection, ESP, and address space layout randomization, which made their way into Windows, Mac, even Linux, and a little less than a decade ago. Now, these defenses were actually designed significantly lessen the damage that the software exploits could inflict by introducing changes to system memory that prevented the execution of the malicious code. Now, even when successfully targeting a buffer overflow or a vulnerability, the exploit resulted only a system or application crash rather than compromising the whole system, making it fatal. Now, ROP allowed attackers to regain the high ground here as well. Rather than using malicious code written by attackers, ROP attacks repurpose the functions that benign applications or OS routines have actually already placed into a region of memory known as the stack. Now, the return, quote, in the ROP refers to the RET instruction that's essential to reordering the code flow. Now, historically here, we know that this is not Intel's first time to try to stop these type of attacks. They have built other security functions into the CPUs with less than stellar results, we know. Now, one is Intel's SGX, short for Software Guard Extension. We've talked about it before here on TWiT, which is supposed to actually carve out impenetrable chunks of protected memory for security-sensitive functions, such as creations of cryptographic keys. Now, another security add-on for Intel is known as the Converged Security and Management Engine, or simply the Management Engine. It's a subsystem inside of Intel's CPUs and chipsets that implements a host of sensitive functions, among others being firmware-based trust platform or TPM modules used for silicon-based encryption and authentication, as well as UEFI BIOS firmware, and as well as used by the Microsoft System Guard and BitLocker. Now, I want to bring my co-host back in because, Curtis, I want to throw this to you first because you've had lots of experience in the industry. This is not Intel's first rodeo here, not first campaign. Do you think it's going to be any different?
Well, I think that what it's going to be is similar to some of their previous campaigns in that it will almost certainly help in the short term. I think that the existing vulnerabilities that are out there, some of the existing attack mechanisms, will in fact be stopped by these new features. I think it's also quite likely that in the future, whether that's 24 months from now or 60 months from now, I don't know. But in the future, someone will find a vulnerability in these. How can I be certain of that? Well, the fact that, A, the Intel architecture is just so complex. Looking at the millions upon millions upon millions of transistors inside the physical package, and then the millions of lines of microcode required to make it work, someone is going to find a vulnerability. And there are people now who do that. The existence of the speculative execution side channels means that more and more researchers are going to be looking for these, and especially researchers in academia, where labor is cheap and expertise is fairly high. So short term, this is a great thing, especially if you're a Windows user. Right. Long term, I think the jury is out, but do I think this will solve the problem forever? Why, no, I don't.
I do want to come back to that comment about Windows, because I think that's actually an important one here, especially in light of some of the latest news that have come out. But Cheebert, I want to throw this to you because, you know, hardware targeting, hardware that's been targeting malware and stopping attacks out there is common to the industry. Is this just to ensure maybe less security researching firms targeting them, or will it increase? I think Curtis kind of brought that up.
You know, I'm in a quandary. You know, it's like, yeah, there's going to Windows and Intel, because of numbers, are the low hanging fruit. They're the ones that these hackers are going to go for. However, if I was going to go and look at a crystal ball, if I was going to make a wish, my wish is that I wish that CPU sockets were going to last longer than one CPU. You know, every time someone comes out, I either have to change out the motherboard if I build my own, or I actually have to retire a machine and work on getting a new one, which adds to the landfills. Gee, wouldn't it be great if there was a CPU socket on the motherboard that would last longer than just one CPU, so that if something like this comes out and I can afford the new Intel or AMD CPU, gee, wouldn't it be great if I could just pop it out, pop in the new one, and then have the new hardware-oriented tools available to me, because the smart boys at Microsoft or Apple or Linux, the Linux teams, are going to be able to take advantage of these new tools and make my system safer, is the hope and crystal ball. So to directly answer your question, yeah, there's always going to be people poking at this stuff. I just want to make sure there's enough tools for the other side to defend me.
Right, right. So, Curtis, I want to throw this back to you for kind of the last question here on this bite. We know that Apple recently announced their race into desktop CPUs and laptops as well. Now, this is news that sparks the enterprise industry that Intel's are kind of targeting here, and obviously Microsoft being the target for a lot of enterprises out there. Do you think that that is a kind of a target towards Apple?
You know, it could be. We haven't seen that the ARM architecture chips that Apple is supposedly going to be announcing that they're heading toward next week are as vulnerable to as many of these speculative execution side channels. They haven't been subject to some of the hardware-based attacks. Does that mean they're invulnerable? Of course it doesn't. What it does mean is that to this point, the market hasn't been big enough to give incentive to researchers to really go in and invest the time to find those vulnerabilities. That may be changing. And Intel wants to do everything it can to make sure that what we have here is a superior chip. I'm optimistic enough to think that Intel really does care about security. But I also know that they are eager to differentiate themselves from whatever it is that Apple may be doing starting next week, and from AMD. Remember, AMD has a non-zero part of the market, and there is a continuing race between Intel and AMD on overall execution speed and feature sets. This is something here that Intel can point to that AMD doesn't have, and that differentiation may actually be more important than whatever is happening between Windows and Mac OS.
That's true. Good point. Good point. We'll have to see how the race continues. Well, that does it for that bite. Let's jump into the next bite. Now, I know organizations are always wondering what the new normal will look like, especially around cybersecurity. Curtis, can you take us through it?
Well, I think I can. Fortunately, this is a story that I wrote that went up today and looked at a really big question. You know, from the way that restaurants operate to the way that sports are played, we've been hearing in the first half of 2020 a lot about a new normal. Is there going to be a new normal for business, for restaurants, for the way we do things coming out of the coronavirus pandemic? Well, the thing that I wanted to know was, is there going to be a new normal in cybersecurity? So I talked to a number of experts and got a number of different opinions, but they all kind of converged on a few points. Bryson Bort, who's the founder of Scythe and Grim and co-founder of the ICS Village, very smart guy who I've talked to a number of times, said, I think it's worth pointing out that there's only two ways security changes: a fundamental change in the business environment, because security is there for business, or if the threat changes. Now, he says that he doesn't see the threat really changing, but what has changed dramatically is the way business is done. So he does see a new normal as something that is essentially required going forward as cybersecurity responds to the changes in the business environment. Now, Kirsten Todd, who's managing director of the Cyber Readiness Institute at the University of Pittsburgh, said that when we deal with the new normal, no company that she has talked with has plans to bring the full workforce back in 2020, if ever. And she sees that as being critical because it's unlikely that even when some critical functions flow back into the centralized offices, it's unlikely that every employee who worked in an office in 2019 will be back in that office in 2021. And so what she sees is a hybrid workforce: small number critical employees in the office, large numbers of employees still working from home. How do we secure that hybrid workforce? Well, a new normal will combine the remote workforce with the secure workspace and create a unified cyber infrastructure that's secure across the entire hybrid environment. Now, of course, that unified cyber infrastructure, if it's going to be effective, it's got to satisfy a number of needs. One of those is balancing the user experience with security. And there are a lot of people that I talked to who said they feel that we've gone too far in the direction of easy user interface, that it's time to pull back a little bit, that it's okay to inject a bit of friction into the process if the result is much greater security. And the thing that one expert said is the new normal is that organizations can no longer have a standard definition and expectation that a single workplace or type of workplace, say the traditional office, is where application access happens. Now, it's important to note that anytime you have device access and application sitting on the same device, you have a critical point at which vulnerabilities can exist. And this new normal means that organizations are going to have to rethink their strategies for access control and identity assurance. You know, in the digital world, we focus more on the trusted devices and IP addresses than validating the human being behind the screen. And a new normal, according to many, should be built more around the granularity of our human nature instead of binary questions like whether that particular device has been seen before or not. That means behavior as an authentication factor. I've talked to a number of people who say that behavior-based authentication is one of the keys to moving forward. You know, thinking about when and where someone is logging in, what they do when they first get there, how they type a password, by which I mean the speed and the rhythm of the characters they type in. All of these are distinctive and all can be used. And all are things that people that I spoke with say are going to have to be used. Another thing is the IoT. You know, people are working from their homes and they have all these smart home devices, all of these entertainment and home control devices out there. What's the security of those? Well, in too many cases, it's not very high. And that's why a number of the experts said that we really do have to get back to including security as a necessary feature for even consumer-based IoT devices, allowing people to change passwords and change admin names, making sure that those devices not only can't be taken over as a member of a botnet, but cannot be used as a pivot point to allow an attacker to get in, get into the home network, and from there into the enterprise network. And finally, there's the notion of security. You know, people are pretty clear about minimal expectations for privacy when they are in the office. But most people have a much different expectation of privacy when they're in, when they are in their own homes, even if they're using company-supplied hardware to do their work. Now, Lou, I want to turn to you. I know that you have been thrust into the position of working from home. Do you see this as something that's going to lead to a new normal, or do you see everything back to being its 2019 self in another, say, 6 to 8 months?
Oh, absolutely a new normal for sure. We already see the increased security measures with organizations, the increased protocols that we have to follow. Obviously, a lot of us are using our own personal devices to access secured resources, and so those security measures need to be very strong to ensure that we're not leaking data, leaking source, that kind of thing. And I know a lot of organizations are pushing that norm to ensure that, you know, obviously people who, they don't want to go and finance everyone's own personal devices as well. And so they're increasing their service layers and their layers within their security system. So I definitely see the new norm staying put for a long time. And I'm actually hoping that that's the case, at least with security and taking measures there, only because I think it's important for organizations to focus on that, continue to focus on that. So I definitely think it's definitely the new norm, and it'll continue for sure.
Well, you know, the new normal as described there is something that I've been working within for a very long time. And I do hope that it becomes more accepted by more organizations, if for nothing else but selfish reasons. Brian, I've got a question for you, and it's on this IoT piece of the puzzle. You know, people said that they think it's important that you be able to change the password and even the admin account name with IoT devices. Do you think that is the only level of change we need to see on IoT if it's going to be part of the new normal?
Well, it's certainly a really, really good start. I'd like to share informal conversation I had at the last Wispapalooza when I was talking to various equipment vendors. You know, as everybody's hearing, I'm actually looking at building a WISP in Honolulu with my business partner. one of the things that really and truly changed my mind about what WISPs are doing versus, say, the big boys like Cox or Time Warner or whoever, Spectrum, sorry, is that there seems to be a really, really big mix and choices available for endpoint equipment. And one of the things that actually came up during a presentation was a home router that could be managed in bulk. And the cool thing was they had standard profiles they called work at home. And basically it was an automated, just check it off and it sets it up, a whole bunch of VLANs and a separate Wi-Fi and all that, so that the IoT gear can be on one network, the kids can be on another, dad or mom working from home can be on a third. I think that should be the new normal. The whole idea of working from home and ignoring the home network security is all part and parcel with the whole conversation about IoT. If the IoT vendors aren't going to pay attention, aren't going to put the effort into securing it, then we had darn well better cordon them off. You know, we still want the functionality, but let's put them on a completely separate network. So if someone does pivot through it, it reduces the attack surface. I think that is going to be my watch phrase for the new normal. Reduce the attack surface and then start doing your work.
Reducing the attack surface, increasing the ability of people to work even when they're not in the office. I think these are going to drive a lot of changes. And I think we're going to be talking about what that new normal is going to look like for at least another 24 to 36 months into the future. Well, that's it for that bite. Now it's time to launch into the rest of TWiET with our magnificent leader, Lou Maresca, telling us about one of our sponsors. Lou, back over to you.
Thank you, Curtis. Well, we'll launch in for sure, but before we get to our guest, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is ExtraHop. Now, the new IT reality is remote access at massive scale, rapid cloud and multi-cloud adoption, and a steady increase in the Internet of Things are all on top of a rise in cybersecurity. So it's more important than ever that organizations see everything going on in their environment, from the cloud to data centers and to their customers. Now, but in order to protect and scale your business, you need more than unified visibility. You also need context for detections and intelligent response workflows so teams can collaborate easily and act fast. Now, ExtraHop helps you detect threats and performance issues up to 95% faster and respond 60% more efficiently than other means. And ExtraHop helps you keep your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Now, there's some great examples out there like Wizards of the Coast. They secure and support their AWS cloud with ExtraHop. Now, Chief Architect and Information Security Officer Daniel McDaniel said, there's no other company that aligns to supporting the DevOps model, the speed and the lack of friction than ExtraHop. Ulta Beauty uses ExtraHop to secure their Google Cloud as well, and keeping their network security and networking teams closely aligned so engineers have more time to focus on innovation. Now, senior IT engineer John Kreese says, before ExtraHop, we had limited visibility into what was going on in the cloud, but now we can quickly identify vulnerabilities and exploits and understand how our applications are performing in the cloud. Now, if you're ready to take control back and ensure you are securing your remote workforce, get tips on securing and supporting remote access or check out the full product demo at extrahop.com/enterprise. That's extrahop.com/enterprise. And we thank ExtraHop for their support of This Week Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the TWiET riot. And today we have Gallen Emery. He's the lead compliance and security architect over at Chef Software. Welcome to the show, Gallen.
Thanks, Lou. Happy to be here.
So our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through a journey of through tech and what brought you to Chef?
Yeah, I have spent a lot of my time as a Windows IT admin. And I remember actually when our Linux guys told me one day about Chef, like, yeah, this is automation thing, does some cool stuff. And then I found out that the Chef HQ is about 2 blocks south of our current office. and then I got recruited by Chef about a couple of weeks later. I was like, this is the cool stuff. This is the right way to solve it. All about automation, all about all that kind of stuff. I ended up in the security space because I spent some time at Chef as our federal architect. So I worked with all of our federal customers for a while, helping them solve problems. A lot of air gap, a lot of high security, a lot of that kind of stuff. And that led naturally into my current role as our lead compliance and security architect.
Fantastic. Now, you kind of alluded to it a little bit. A lot of IT pros out there, they kind of understand what Chef is. Some of them are already using it. Can you maybe take us through what Chef is and how it's helping?
Yeah, so we came out of the infrastructure as code movement before the term kind of DevOps showed up. We've been a big proponent of DevOps. Now we're talking a lot of DevSecOps. But really what we focus on is helping you create an artifact that is your workload in whatever kind of fashion that might be in the areas we focus on, then helping you deploy that out to production in a safe, repeatable, scalable way, right? So it's really about automation, DevOps, you know, putting things as code, infrastructure as code, security as code, compliance as code, that kind of stuff.
Right. Now, a lot of times you hear kind of almost in tandem, you have your Chef and Puppet. Sounds like a show, actually, go together. Can maybe talk about how they go together? Do they symbiotically work together, or are they different things, or how they work together?
We're different things. So Chef and Puppet have been around for a long time. There's a couple other players in the same space. And we all kind of try to solve a couple pieces of the problem, right? I'd say in the established kind of configuration management, desired state configuration management space, there's a lot of really good tools out there, really good equivalencies. For the most part, when we're talking to customers at this point, it's, hey, use the thing that makes the most sense for you. If you're built and structured in a way that works for Puppet, go for it. We have a lot of things on the compliance and security and application sides that aren't quite in that same space anymore, and that's really where our focus is today.
So yeah, that brings me kind of to my next question. I think a lot of organizations are trying to evaluate kind of a continuous integration, deployment, delivery. Maybe we could take a step back for a second. What should organizations be looking for here in solutions?
I think the biggest thing we want to really focus on is this creating and deploying and testing an artifact, right? When we're thinking about immutable infrastructures, when we're thinking about containerization, that's really what they're trying to get to is this, how do I create an artifact that is tested, that's safe, that I have integrity checks on? How do I put that through a pipeline? How do I do all those kinds of things? And so when you're looking for solutions, this kind of if this, then that kind of solution procedural stuff, it's really falling away. We really need to focus on how do I create a thing that is the entirety of my application stack, the entirety of my system, talking to my hypervisors, talking to the cloud, all that stuff as a repeatable artifact so that if it all goes away, I can rebuild it from code.
Right. Okay, so we hear you talk a little bit about Puppet. There is another player in there that we talk that's kind of in the workflow, it seems like, Ansible. Can you maybe give us how that's kind of versus Puppet and Chef and how that kind of fits in?
Yeah, I think it's still in the kind of, you know, desired state configuration management space. Ansible's done a really good job of focusing on, I'm just going to take an admin and tell them, you just run the same script against 1,000 systems, right? Really right. Great, really quick forced win on that. We've recently added a number of pieces around target mode and pieces like that to help customers in the Chef space do some of those things. Again, thinking into the structure of how I want to build my systems, I'm really trying to figure out what is that artifact of policy that I want to create is really the key thing. Obviously, Ansible now is owned by Red Hat, owned by IBM, so they've got a bunch of big weight behind them. I will say I don't see them a lot in the Windows space, I think, as a result of that.
Right. Okay, so let's kind of get into the Chef ecosystem a little bit. We hear a lot about the cookbook and recipes, all those different analogies. How do they fit into the ecosystem for Chef?
Yeah, so when you're working with Chef, you're writing resources. I personally think we missed the opportunity here to call them ingredients. We have such a good pun set all the way down, we just kind of missed the last little piece. Hopefully my bosses will hear this and finally make that shift for me. That's not going to happen. But so anyway, so we write these resources. Resources go into recipes. So a resource is an individual task or an individual item I want to do. I want to create this file. I want to manage this user. I want to install this application. They go into a recipe, which is a set of things to do a task, right? I'm going to try to build an Apache server. Maybe this is like Active Directory configuration, you know, installing antivirus, all that kind of stuff. And those go into a cookbook. A cookbook is versioned. We can test it. We have a testing apparatus called Test Kitchen. all these kinds of things around us so we can test these cookbooks, and they together kind of come and create this run list, run policy. We use a policy file now as the most common artifact for it. The policy file is the basically everything your system needs to know in order to deploy itself to its configured state. So all of our security hardening goes in there, all of our application policy goes in there, all the infrastructure specific things like adding it to Active Directory, any users I add, all that kind of stuff goes into this entire document. And that document is a locked artifact that allows us to repeatedly deploy the exact same configuration to any system we want.
Fantastic. Yeah, I was going to kind of dig into the policies a little bit more because I'm sure that it has a lot of things, lots of things to do with security as well. But really quick on from a kind of setup perspective, how does one kind of get started with Chef? How do they deploy? They have to deploy a server somewhere. Can it be in the cloud? Can it be on-prem? That kind of thing.
Yeah, so we operate in a pretty standard command and control structure for a lot of our products. But what we really found a lot is that when you're getting started, you don't need that command and control structure. Usually you're just kind of playing on your own workstation. So grab the binaries from us, bring them down, start writing recipes. We actually have a great site, learn.chef.io, which has a lot of self-guided training. It's all free. A lot of it you can actually do with a kind of a cloud shell we give you there. And just start playing with it. Start writing individual resources, write inspect policies to test and repair your system. And so that you can see kind of how this thing translates to how you would do it manually, and then really going from there.
Fantastic. Now, when you're deploying Chef, is there some kind of really high level baseline things that people should be doing to ensure that it's secure, that it's easy to maintain, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so most of our traditional customers are using a Chef server as the kind of policy distribution point from it. And the clients you talk to with the Chef server are connecting through public-private key pair. And the Chef server is an important piece. It's the central command and control structure. It's got all the policy stored there, all your authentications there. You should secure that box, right? That's not a thing that everybody should get to. You guys were just talking about, you know, all the ways in which the security edge is shifting in the new, you know, 2020 culture. Like, that's an important thing. There was a great DEF CON talk a couple years ago where somebody did a bunch of things, but they basically were like, yeah, so I've already owned the Chef server, and then I do all these things. They're like, okay, well, yeah. If you own the Chef server, then yes, you're kind of screwed. That's true with really any of them. But yeah, so focus on the security of that. The key thing that's really nice is that when you have a tool like Chef in place, we can easily get a lot of policy out to your systems really quickly. We've seen this very effective for zero-day remediation. A number of customers have solved shell shock, Heartbleed. You know, you pick it, and I guarantee you that we've got customers who have used it to quickly determine and resolve a security vulnerability in really a matter of about 15 to 20 minutes.
Right. Well, when we come back, we want to talk a little bit more about some of the new things that Chef has come out with, especially the focus on DevSecOps. Before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. Now, let me ask you, where are all the professionals today? Well, you know, they're on LinkedIn. That's right. The world is changing and businesses are adapting in new ways. And in these uncertain times, how do you make sure marketing gets the results you need? Well, LinkedIn can help you reach people who are looking for opportunities to help their business and can focus your campaigns on the objectives for today so your marketing works better. Now, with over 62 million decision makers out there on LinkedIn, you're able to connect with the right business leaders, people who are they're there to learn. They want to know how to be more effective with their jobs and find products to help their companies. Now, 71% of people say they use the information they find on LinkedIn to help them inform their business decisions. And with LinkedIn ads, you can make sure your message is getting through to the right people. Now, LinkedIn marketing can help you build campaigns using objective-based advertising, now allowing you to customize the campaign experience based on the action you want a customer to take, whether it's trying to drive clicks to a website, generate leads, or even generate video views. Now, LinkedIn has the targeting tools that can help you focus on reaching your precise audience down to their job title, company name, location, and more. In fact, you can reach people who you already know based on who has visited your site or who have contacted in the past. Now, LinkedIn ads help all types of businesses get the marketing results they need today. Now, when I post things on LinkedIn, I can tell you I get a ton of engagement. In fact, especially the people I want to engage, those professionals that I essentially want to target. And when I posted some work I was doing on Office Developer Platform, I got a ton of responses because the session I just did, most of the people said in that session said, hey, I got your information and I got that information from LinkedIn. Now, as a podcast network, we've used LinkedIn Marketing Solutions many times for Twit, and we really like how it's able to reach a wider professional audience that ultimately expands our presence. It's specifically great because once you're on the platform, you can steer the direction of the campaign easily. Now, see how LinkedIn can help you with a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit to launch your first campaign. Visit LinkedIn.com/Twiet. That's LinkedIn.com/TWIET. Terms and conditions apply. And we thank LinkedIn Marketing Solutions for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Gallen Emery. He's the lead compliance and security architect over at Chef Software. Now, Gallen, I want to talk a little bit about some of the new things that are coming out, because sometime this year, Chef kind of stopped referring to itself as the leader in DevOps and instead has started calling itself the leader in DevSecOps. Can you maybe take us through that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we've realized is that this idea of security operations and, you know, hardening systems and all this stuff has been really a part of DevOps for a long time. And, you know, there's plenty of people who will argue about, does DevSecOps need to exist? Isn't just DevOps? Doesn't always have security. What I'd say in particular that we're focused on is that security has a role in the structure, right? Obviously, we know security and compliance are inviolable. We must have them. But nobody's really thought about, how do I help security get into Agile? How do I get them into Lean and DevOps and into kind of these structures for operating? So that's really what we're focused on. We've been helping operations teams solve security hardening problems now for over a decade. And what we're really focused on in these last couple of years is really saying, hey, look, security, let's help you get that security policy. Let's help you understand the security threat model. Let's understand how automation works and improves your job in this kind of new ultra-modern, ultra-fast world.
Right. Now, you've actually seen quite a bit of focus. Obviously, a lot of businesses are having a lot of issues with keeping up with compliance and focusing on security there. How has Chef kind of focused on that now?
Yeah, so we've launched a couple new, really important, really useful products to our customers. So the first is Chef Compliance. Chef Compliance is taking the existing stuff we already had, the existing tools in Chef Infra and Chef Inspec, and really providing a lot of secured, validated policy from us. So we take the Center for Internet Security benchmarks, we take them, we wrap them into we process them into Inspec, and we test them, validate them, and actually get them certified by CIS. So if you are a Chef Compliance customer, you actually have a full chain of custody on your security policy all the way back to CIS through us. What this allows us to do is to use security or compliance as code to automatically and continuously test compliance across the entire infrastructure. The other thing we added recently just at ChefConf a couple weeks ago is the ability for us to do remediation using that same kind of content. So this allows a customer to come to us and say, hey, let's go use CIS at the baseline. Let's use that to build our customer-specific policy because, let's be honest, nobody follows CIS to 100%. And then using that information, go ahead and build the remediation policy on top of that and be able to apply that out to the fleet. When we do that really effectively, what we get is a continuous compliance viewpoint of our entire infrastructure.
Now, we also have a little bit about Chef Desktop, which was recently introduced. How's that helping and how's that kind of fit in?
Yeah, that's the other one that's really important and really interesting right now is, you know, especially this wasn't really planned around kind of coronavirus 2020, but it actually works out really, really well for us. We've been working on this for a while. We have another number of customers using Chef Infra and Chef Inspec to solve desktop management problems. Frustrated with the GUI-specific tools of yesterday. And so we really started building a focused offering around this to say, hey, look, what type of content should we bring into the desktop space? How do we make sure that the desktop experience is really important and useful? One of the things that's really interesting when you switch from servers to desktops is that a desktop has an implied user aspect to it, right? Somebody's making changes to the box. There's other things outside of it. So the desktop offering is about, again, that system hardening, that basic configuration, that automatic device management. So like if your vendor enrolls in that, like literally my MacBook from Chef, when I pull it out of the box from Apple, literally opens up and installs Chef Desktop on itself to manage itself as it goes forward. And what this allows us to do and what our customers are using this for is to implement things like Zero Trust and BeyondCorp, right? As we're thinking about the security edge that is now shifting into the home network side you guys were talking about just a few minutes ago, we really have a different edge problem to deal with. And so we really have to focus on that mobile device, that edge device management in a way we never had to before, right? We were rest assured that was inside of our corporate world, inside of our corporate firewalls. And so this allows our customers to solve all those problems wherever the device might be. Again, focus on continuous automation and continuous compliance and management.
Fantastic. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in. Let's start with you, Brian, first.
So, Galen, I used to work in the dark environment, shall we say. I worked a lot on DoD classified systems. And one of my biggest challenges is I had a whole bunch of checklists that I had to do. Chain of custody is a really big deal. My question is, can Chef work on an isolated system, or does it have to call back to something? So could I run like NISPOM Chapter 7 checklists?
Yeah. So actually, one of my favorite customers I get to work with is General Dynamics. They're working with one of the large Intel agencies here in the U.S., and they run all this stuff fully air-gapped. It's a big component of mine. It's one of the big things we talk about internally, is that making sure all of our stuff runs air-gapped. Obviously, you need to get the content from us through the web, but again, we have secure chain of custody there. You walk it across to your air-gapped network in however way you do it. My favorite is always the wonderful sneaker net of just, you know, a single DVD literally in someone's hands, walking it into the SCIF. And when you're in there, everything works exactly as it would otherwise. Again, this is one of the key pieces of the artifact-based deployment model, is that when I build the artifact's the same no matter what environment I deploy it onto. If it's on-prem, if it's bare metal, if it's cloud, if it's like a government cloud, doesn't matter to us, right? It's all the same kind of compute at the end.
That's pretty awesome. You know, I used to work in J2. And so you know what a SCIF is. That's a big deal. So the whole deal, you know, we're talking about probably a Linux server or something as the Chef server. I'm sorry, I'm showing my ignorance here. So I have a chain of custody, I can set it all up. What kinds of things does a person need? You know, what do I need? Do I need a Linux server? Can I get a container? How do I get started?
Yeah, so we've recently, using actually Chef Habitat, one of our application delivery pieces, started encapsulating the Chef client and its policy together into an artifact that I can deploy even without the Chef server. So in the simplest implementation, I can take this artifact and I can deploy it to any system I want to deploy it to. The artifact you build is going to be basically built for Linux or for Windows. We can also, when we're talking about application delivery and talking about hardening, we can also use Habitat, these pieces, to deploy and harden a container as well. And the basic structure is that, again, we're talking about chain of custody, right? So what I really need is a trusted artifact store inside my environment, right? For an enterprise deployment, this is what I need. And I need to build that artifact store in a trusted way. And the best way we've seen for customers to do that, the best way to solve this problem, is to put a CI and CD pipelines in front of it. And what we can do when we do this right, and what we've seen, is really create this human-free production zone, where what we do is, by putting all the access control into our source code management, into a Git repository of some sort, having our pipeline pick it up from there and deploy to the artifact store, and then our production systems will grab from that artifact store themselves, that allows us to actually remove SSH, WinRM, RDP, obviously Telnet's removed already, but remove that remote access from your production systems, because the only thing that matters is that artifact, and that artifact is deployed to the artifact store. You can trust the artifact because you have the whole chain of custody back to the source code. And when we're thinking about access control and access management, right, I think Curtis was talking about this earlier, with the rethink where we have those components, we can have that conversation back in source code and say, hey, two-person rule exists over here. We can validate this all the way through, and automation just takes care of the rest.
Fantastic. Well, do you want to bring Curtis back in? Because I know he's got some questions.
I do, and one of my questions really is from the old IT guy perspective. I can hear you describing everything that Chef does, and in my mind, I can hear somebody going, well, we could do all of that with pick your favorite scripting language. So really, you know, tell me, what is it that Chef is providing? Is it just the management piece that is the huge difference, or is it a more profound advantage that you provide over the old, let's just carve it out of out of stone method of making these things happen.
Yeah, we like to say that tools reinforce culture and culture reinforces tools, right? And so if we're talking about legacy tools like bash scripting and even just, you know, remoting to a system and making changes to the system directly, yeah, you can solve problems that way, but they don't scale very well, right? And if you were to use, like, let's just say we're going to use bash and PowerShell as the mechanism for it, well, now I have to ship all that around, right? I have to find some way to manage it. PowerShell has a server. Well, how do I test it? How do I do all those things? Chef gives me a very clear way to do it that's repeatable, that works across platforms. It's the same structure if it's a Linux system I'm targeting versus a Windows system versus potentially some container pieces. And I'm getting really clear about that structure of what I want to create, right? Again, I'm trying to create a hardened artifact that is both my application workload plus my security policy plus my security remediation, really all kind of tied together and tested together. And it's all those things combined. And I'd say the last piece in particular that we've really expanded into in the last month or two is this certified content, right? When you're talking about security and compliance, we need to know that the baseline is coming from a place of trust. Because if it's not, then when an auditor shows up, the auditor is going to go, okay, well, I don't trust any of this, so we're going to audit all of it, right? And if we want to have automation be the king, be the kind of the key to our audit and compliance story, then we need to make sure we can prove to the auditors and to compliance teams, hey, this system is secure, and this system is identical in its security to all these other systems. Right. And if I can prove that, then all I have to do is spot check a few systems. We can sign off the audit and we can get along with our day.
OK, all of that sounds great. I'm sold. I'm ready to go. How big a hill on a learning curve am I going to have to eat to get there? You know, let's say that I did start out. I have started out on things like, you know, bash script. How big is the learning curve? Is it a big, tall, vertical learning curve that I've got to eat in order to get started with Chef?
No, it's not. It's a really nice, small one. And so one of the key things, again, with that content is that if we're talking about system hardening and security, all of the content to do the work is already written and managed by us. Your job is to toggle on and off the things that you do or don't want in your systems. And we do that today in a YAML file. We're adding more features into our UI to make it easier to do it outside of that structure. And really the key is that, like, look, let's just get you going 80, 90% of the way there. If you have already written a bunch of bash or PowerShell to manage your systems beyond the CIS benchmarks, beyond the baselines, one of the key things that we can do is we can just add that content in as is. If we wanted to make a desired state, kind of configuration management, you know, DSC style, then we add what we call guards around it. So we can take all of your existing work today and use that to kind of go forward as we go through this process. And so it's a really quick, clean, easy way to get there. We provide most of the content today. You layer into the things you already have on top of it. And then we have a Ruby native DSL that allows us to write new things if you need to expand the problem set. And we have that because guess what? We have complex systems with complex problems, and so we need to have a way that allows us to solve them when we hit them.
So, Galen, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time, so I wanted to give you a chance to tell the folks over where people can go, learn more about Chef, maybe DevSecOps, and learn more about getting started.
Yeah. So the best place to go is chef.io. It's our homepage. We've got a bunch of great things there. We also, of course, have specific product pages. We talked today about compliance and about desktop, really key new offerings from Chef. We've also got a bunch of things on the application delivery side that allow us to do similar pieces. Then one of the key things as well to get started is learn.chef.io. I mentioned that earlier. That's really the best place to get going, get started, get your hands wet, and really kind of figure out how this thing operates and how it flows for the particular problem that you're trying to solve.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the Best Thing Enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune in a device near you to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on with you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
I'm packing. That's going to be my standard answer for a while. But on Twitter, I am ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. Or if you want, Chebert at twit.tv, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T. Yes, my students had a Dilbert theme when they're naming. And of course, I had to be Chebert. But, you know, why don't you send an email to Twyatt at twit.tv and hits all the hosts. Love to hear from you. And back to you, Lou.
Thank you very much. We also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, Senior Editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on with you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you and all of your fantastic work?
Well, as usual, you can find me at darkreading.com, and especially at the edge of Dark Reading. And we're already beginning to get ready for Black Hat. You know, even though it won't be an in-person event, it's going to be a massive virtual event. I've been going through the program. I'm starting to interview some of the speakers. Lots of great stuff coming up to prepare for Black Hat. And in addition, I've got things like, well, the article I talked about today in my bite, the new normal for cybersecurity. And I'm also, in the coming week, going to have a piece up on what we're learning or choosing not to learn during the coronavirus pandemic. Some interesting stuff there about the kinds of things that people are taking as online classes and the certifications they're interested in during this time. So I hope you'll come over, take a look, and let me know what you think. You can follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA or on Instagram at Kurt_Franklin.
Thank you, Curtis. Some great stuff coming up. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There we'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, guest information, and links for the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to the videos there, you'll actually get those helpful and subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version, video version, or even your HD video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices and including on any one of your podcast applications as well. I used my my Amazon device the other day and just said, play Twyatt Podcast. And there we go. It was playing right away. Now, it's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. So after you subscribe, you can also impress your friends and your family members and your coworkers. Share the gift of Twyatt to help them go understand the IT and enterprise news for the week. Now, if you already subscribed and you're available live right now at Fridays 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on Fridays here, we do the show live. You can see how the pizza is made. You can go check it out by live.twit.tv. There we are live all the time, and we show everything behind the scenes, the start of the show, the end of the show, all of our bloopers, all of that stuff right then and there. And if you're going to actually watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room live as well. We have a great set of characters, irc.twit.tv. We get some great discussion points from there, some great questions. So definitely jump in the chat room as well if you're going to watch the show live. Now, if you can't be part of the live chat, live discussion, we also still have an amazing community out there as well. You can join the 24/7 community and discussion over at twit.community. It's a great new website. All the hosts are out there. The Twit community is out there. We post about the shows. We post a lot of questions about tech and a lot of the different social things that are going on today. So definitely have a really great discussion out there at twit.community. Again, if you can't make it live, you might as well jump in and be part of the conversation. Now, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits, and I have some really great conversations with people like you as well. Plus, I also post what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. And in fact, you can in fact check out a lot of things that we're doing right now at developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post all the latest and greatest ways to customize your office experience to make it more productive and useful for your organization. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we could not do this show without them. So thank you to all of them and their support. Of course, thank you to all the staff and engineers at Twit. We couldn't do this show without them, so thank you for all their support. And also, thank you again to Mr. Brian Chiebert. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we couldn't do the show without him. So thanks again, Chiebert, for all your support and all of your help. Now, before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Jeff. Jeff, you've been our rock during this remote time. Thank you so much. How's everything going over there, Twitter? Are you still alone in the studio, or has it been starting to trickle back in?
One person comes back in on Friday now, our controller. So she's working in there a full day, which is great. And a little quiet, but Anthony comes in to do our Twit After Hours on Friday, and he's preparing that right now. So I think they have something really special lined up. And I just want to say great job today, guys. Also, the sync and the audio and everything was really on. And also, I want to say great guest today.
Fantastic. Thanks, Jeff. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, folks, I am Micah Sargent, co-host of Tech News Weekly right here on the Twit Network. Yes, Tech News Weekly is a show we do every week, Jason Howell and myself, where we talk to people who are making and a break in the tech news. That's right. It's journalists, it's inventors, it's app makers, it's everybody who's bringing the tech news in a given week. It's all the stuff you want to know about in bite-sized chunks in a fantastic package. So be sure to subscribe. It's twit.tv/TNW.